Hello, and welcome to The World in 30 Minutes, the podcast on the events, policies, and ideas that will shape the world from the European Council on Foreign Relations. My name is Mark Leonard. I'm director of ECFR. And this week's podcast is all about de-risking. This buzzword is currently being thrown around everywhere, from European Commission reports to speeches by Chinese diplomats and board meetings in the United States. But what does de-risking actually refer to? What will the effects of de-risking be for Europe and for the global economy? To help us make sense of this topic, we have an all-star cast of two experts who are joining us. First up, we have Agathe Demarais, who is returning to the podcast. She is a senior policy fellow at ECFR and is leading our work on geoeconomics. But before that, she was the global forecasting director at the Economist Intelligence Unit, and she also wrote a very respected book on sanctions called Backfire: How Sanctions Reshape the World Against US Interests. And also on the podcast, we have Stephen Adams, who is a senior director at Global Council, where he supports the trade, investment, and financial services policy practices. He's had about a decade of experience in private practice advising clients like that. But before that, he spent over a decade working in public service as an advisor the European Commissioner on DG Trade, an advisor to British Secretary of State for Business, and he's even worked in the European Parliament. So welcome to the podcast, both of you. So why don't we start with this sort of big question, which is what is de-risking? You've both been writing and trying to explain that to different audiences. We've had various discussions on it about it on the podcast in the past, and the difference between de-risking and decoupling. But why don't we just go back to basics? Agathe, you've written quite a few articles, including several pieces in Foreign Policy on different parts of de-risking. How would you describe what de-risking means, where it comes from, what it means to kind of move from decoupling to de-risking?
Well, actually, I love the way you framed the question, Mark, because it's all about this move from decoupling to de-risking. So I think it's really interesting to first answer the question of why we don't talk about decoupling anymore, because a few years ago, it was all about decoupling. But I think that there is this realization nowadays, certainly in the US and also in Europe, that the Chinese economy is simply too big to decouple from it. It just doesn't work. Because yes, by the way, the elephant in the room is de-risking, decoupling. It's all about China. This is not something that we hear specifically in Europe, but it's all about China. And the Chinese economy is just too big to decouple from it. And also, you were hinting at the fact that this decoupling, de-risking trend will have implications for the global economy. Well, I would say that a full decoupling between Western economies on the one hand and China on the other hand will also accelerate the fragmentation of the global economy. And that's not a very desirable prospect for Western economies, because emerging countries may well choose to side with China. And then finally, the third reason why I think we're moving away from decoupling is that cutting all ties to China carries risks, because when you have economic ties, you have leverage. And of course, here the question is all about a potential war around Taiwan. What economic leverage, what sanctions could Western economies impose on China in such a scenario if they don't have economic ties anymore on China? So then to go to your question about defining de-risking, well, I think it's about three things. It's about reducing economic reliance on China, especially for critical goods. I think that the pandemic has really shown that when you import your masks or your medicine from a single country, it's a bit of a risk. So it's all about this critical goods reliance thing. So reducing that. And then the second objective is also from the US perspective, because the US is really, well, I would say leading on the de-risking front. It's also about preserving US technological superiority, because the US sees this and China sees it too as a key determinant of economic power. And relatedly, it's all about not fueling the advances of the Chinese military. But I think that when we take a look at the broad picture, what is really clear is that there is no single agreed definition of de-risking. And of course, this yields very interesting questions about the direction of travel here.
Thanks a lot. That was a very comprehensive explanation of how we got to where we're at the moment. But what you didn't do was go that much into the question of what is a risk, which we're trying to get rid of. Maybe, Stephen, you can tell us what the main risks are which are being de-risked.
Well, what I can do is I can tell you what the risks look like for the kinds of companies that a firm like mine does due diligence for. And obviously, in many ways, what they're looking at is the same picture that Agatha has just described, but what they're looking at, the way they're looking at it is from the idiosyncratic reality of their supply chain or their cross-border structure. And obviously, that means that the answer to the question, what is de-risking, really comes down to the question of what is the risk you're worried about. Now, I mean, I think that there are maybe three that we would flag straight away, and they're all broadly linked to this, to the challenge that we've just heard described, which is essentially the challenge of, can you continue to operate in China in a way that doesn't cut you off from the huge economic benefits of the Chinese market while protecting yourself from a series of risks imposed, generally speaking, by Western policy. And they would be, I think, the three main buckets to think about would be essentially subversion risk. So the kinds of risks that are now increasingly being flagged by security services in Europe and particularly the US that force firms to think quite carefully about the way in which the parts of their operation that are exposed to China are therefore exposed to subversion risk over time. The second is the risk of being...
People throw these words around. What does subversion actually mean in practice?
So subversion risk would mean simply what we would have described 15 years ago as corporate espionage. But in this case, corporate espionage conducted in the service of a state.
So stealing intellectual property.
It's unlikely. Well, it might be stealing intellectual property. It's probably more likely to be stealing forms of commercial of proprietary information beyond IP, essentially trade secrets. It could be, and of course this is the other dimension of subversion, is that it's perceived to be access to critical infrastructure and the ability to use or to influence critical infrastructure through a commercial operation. So any firm that's plugged into the cloud, any firm that's plugged into critical infrastructure in any way and has Chinese nationals working for it, and if those Chinese nationals are subject to, as most Chinese nationals are, things like the Chinese national intelligence law, then that's going to be seen by national security policymakers as a potential source of risk, and firms will start thinking proactively about how they can mitigate against that. Beyond that, you'll be thinking about your supply chain out of China into the US in particular, although increasingly, of course, there are product sets that are potentially implicated by things like EU trade defense measures. So you'll be worrying about whether goods produced in China as part of your supply chain and then sold into Europe or the US might be subject to tariffs. And increasingly, of course, you're thinking about things like supply chain due diligence frameworks. You're asking yourself whether the emerging set of statutory obligations around reporting and disclosure on your supply chain where it relates to China potentially exposes you to reputational risk. So any one of those three things or a mix of them might be...
So just to be clear, so the second two are less about China, it's more about Western policy towards China, that you could suddenly find that your inputs from China get blocked or become much more expensive as a result of tariffs or other.
Or they might give rise to reputational issues if you're perceived, if you are found to be, for example, using material inputs from Xinjiang. The first one is about Western policy as well, because it's a shift in the way in which in national security policymakers are thinking about where risk sits in a Western corporate. And they're not just thinking about it anymore in terms of things like control, or domicile, or ownership. They're thinking about it through this prism of potential for state-backed corporate espionage.
Okay. But on the third, I'm going to come back to Agathe in a second, but just on the third, what's the difference between your third one and your second one? So the second one is basically about tariffs. And what was the third one? The reputational risk.
So the one of the big changes in the way in which public policymakers have thought about supply chains, and particularly in the EU, is around the creation of reporting and disclosure frameworks, such as the German supply chain due diligence law, which is now being Europeanized, that create obligations for firms to report on a whole range of practices down their supply chain, including in some cases in their secondary suppliers. And that's designed essentially to make large multinationals risk averse about sourcing goods out of markets where standards may be lower than European policymakers would.
So they could be environmental standards. It could be,
environmental standards, labor standards. Yeah. If it's Xinjiang, it's going to be human rights.
Yeah. Okay, great. Fantastic. Very clear. Agathe, you wanted to come in.
Yes, I actually think that what is really interesting here is the way that we frame this conversation. You know, in my definition of de-risking, I was focusing on policies from governments. And what Stephen highlighted is that this is all implemented by the private sector. And I think that the broader picture here is that there is a trend, and that's certainly a trend that has been happening for a few decades when you think about sanctions, for instance, or economic statecraft in general, about foreign policy, the one from government, being implemented by private firms. And I think that this is really an interesting trend to explore, because de-risking at the end of the day is all about asking private firms to do less business with China, and so be maybe a little less profitable because of foreign policy aims, because the broader picture is, of course, about the conflict, rising conflict between Western economies and China. So I thought it's a very interesting, actually, and then way to see things.
So you've both been talking about de-risking as a multi-dimensional phenomenon, but also as if it's like a unitary thing. But do people mean the same when they talk about de-risking in Washington and in Brussels, or are they, is this a sort of classic thing that Oscar Wilde talked about divided by a common language?
No, I think there's a material difference. I think European policymakers have been uncomfortable from the start with the language of decoupling, uncomfortable politically, but also uncomfortable practically, for the reasons that Agathe has described, which is that they're very skeptical that it's feasible, in a way that I think some American policymakers actually would continue to indulge the idea that actually decoupling is realistic. I mean, I think the interesting thing is that within company level strategies, you actually, one of the responses to the imperative to de-risk is in fact to adopt a model of internal decoupling. And what I mean by that is that you try and devise a cross-border corporate structure in which your operations in China serve China and your operations outside of China serve the rest of the world. And you aim to build a series of firewalls between that Chinese operation and the rest of the world operation that protects you from things like subversion risk, tariffication on, you know, if you're importing goods into the US. So actually we come back to the decoupling idea, not as a state-driven concept, but actually as a corporate hedge against perceived risk. The idea that you can somehow continue to have a foot in both camps, but you can create a deep enough ditch between those two operations that policymakers will accept it or tolerate it, at least for now.
If we sort of stick with the point about company, because there was a big debate in Germany when it introduced its China strategy around this idea of de-risking. And there was a debate about whether the government should, decentralize the de-risking to companies in the way that you're talking about, where companies should work out what their risks are and should just be encouraged to mitigate against those risks, versus whether Germany as a kind of nation should have a sense of how risky different types of contact with China were. And a lot of people in the run-up to that saying we shouldn't make the same mistakes on China that we made on Russia. And we're talking about the kind of dependence of the German economy on Russian gas. I personally not totally convinced that German foreign policy has ever been influenced by the dependence on Russian gas. I mean, it's quite interesting how happy Germans have been to have sanctions against Russia, even to get rid of Nord Stream 2. I think that strategy has actually driven economics rather than the other way around. But that was a big debate in Germany. Can you both talk a bit about the sort of balance between those two and both how it played out in Germany, but also what that means for a kind of wider debate?
I think actually it's really interesting that you mentioned Germany here, because what I wanted to mention about your previous question is that definitely I agree with Stephen. It's not the same understanding of what de-risking is between both sides of the Atlantic. I think that when we take a look at the US, we have a very clear strategy in terms of the sectors, in terms of the tools such as export controls, and the direction of travel. I think that this direction of travel is certainly lacking in Europe when we take a look at things. And Germany is a very good example of this, actually, of one of the reasons why this is happening. Because Germany is quite reliant on China from the economic perspective. You know, what we see is that German firms have a huge presence in China. They have revenues in China, which amount to about 6% of Germany's GDP. And also, you know, there's this huge economic reliance on Chinese imports across Europe. And I think that this explains the debate that you're pointing at, you know, that there is no good answer yet in Europe about how to do de-risking. Because the question that you pose is essentially about how you do de-risking. Should it be about the state mandating things? Should it be about companies having to think about their supply chains and their individual risk at the micro level? Or should it be more about the macro level? And I don't think there is any good answer about this in Europe yet, because there is this fragmentation, some European countries being more exposed to China than others. Also, this lack of consensus about what de-risking is. You know, it was your first question, and I'm pretty sure that if you ask a number of experts, everyone will have a different answer. And also, there is this question about how to get companies on board. You know, when you look at the US, you have the IRA. You have $369 billion, which is about industrial policy. But this industrial policy is geared towards de-risking from China, especially for clean tech. In Europe, at the moment, you don't really have room for maneuver in the fiscal space to do that. So how do you convince companies to be a little less profitable for foreign policy objectives? I think this is a very, very difficult question to answer, especially as the situation is so different across different EU member states.
The other question I was sort of wondering is, you had quite a sort of narrow definition. I mean, you know, it's quite big, but you had those three types of risk when asked you what the risk was, Stephen. But what you didn't mention was some of the other risks that people talk about. One risk is about, you know, what happens if there's a war on Taiwan, for example, which is a sort of big mega geopolitical risk, which would, you know, could have quite big implications on the global economy and on supply chains. And the question is, you know, should you act as if that's definitely going to happen, and therefore see that as a good reason to change your relationship with China? Another thing which people talk about a lot are the asymmetries between the sort of Chinese market and their state capitalist system, which is very closed and very subsidized, and the sort of markets that we have. So a lot of Europeans are very concerned about what happened to the solar panel industry in Europe, and they sort of fear that other sectors could go down a similar route if you allow the Chinese access to intellectual property or other things like that, where they can use this big closed home market to put themselves in a different situation. Are those part of de-risking, and how do they fit into it? These would be more kind of macro things, and might mean, I mean, they go beyond, you know, dangers of subversion and tariffs and things like that.
They do, but I think at the end of the day, they're the far end of that spectrum, and the risk of kinetic conflict, of an invasion of Taiwan, is there in the background when firms think about internal decoupling. Because essentially, at the end of the day, internal decoupling is about how you structure your supply chain or your production model in such a way that if you had to accept an element of expropriation, or if you had to leave a certain amount of value on the table in the Chinese market in a worst case scenario, how would you minimize that? And a model in which you produce in China to sell to the Chinese domestic market and produce outside of China to sell to the rest of the world, in a worst case scenario, and in one that's of course still very value destructive, is a hedge against that risk. I mean, to be honest, I think a lot of corporates will say, if you're facing expropriation risk in China, we've probably got bigger things to worry about, if you take my point.
Yeah, I just completely agree with that. In my conversations with corporates, what I hear very often is, okay, if we're talking about a war around Taiwan, we're doomed anyway, so we're not really going to prepare for a scenario. And it sounds very far away also, because many corporate strategies, or short to medium term, whereas a war over Taiwan sounds more like a long-term risk. Maybe it could happen sooner than that, but I think it's very difficult to get corporate boards interested in a hypothetical risk, which is more long-term looking.
If the Chinese market wasn't so big and so attractive, then firms would be much more binary. The reason you adopted an internal decoupling strategy is because China is just such a huge part of the global economy. It's often the hedge against against things like demographic change in the European market or uncertain economic performance in the US market. And if it wasn't China, then I think we would see firms behaving in a much more binary way. But China is sui generis in that respect.
So I like to spin the kind of telescope round at some point and look at this from a Chinese perspective. But maybe before we do that, I can just ask one more question, which is that, you know, if you were buying stocks in de-risking, you know, it's been a kind of growth market in recent years. Everyone's developing strategies. We're hearing more and more about it. It's cropping up in more and more policy documents. But there's also a sense that some of this is maybe quite fake if you actually look at the ways that globalization's developing. So when I was in China last summer, a lot of Chinese economists were telling me that actually some of the things which look like de-risking are just rebadging, really. So, for example, US trade with China has gone down in some sectors, has gone up with ASEAN, particularly with Vietnam and other countries. But what happened was that at the same time, Chinese trade for unfinished products with Vietnam has gone up in almost exactly the same proportion that the trade with the US went down. And things are basically going from the Chinese market being rebadged into Vietnamese products and then imported to the US. Another kind of example is the amount of Chinese investment in Mexico, where a lot of things are now kind of flowing into the US market through NAFTA. If there were a war in Taiwan, the exposure which the US had to China would not be affected by this, even though it's obviously very good for the Vietnamese and the Mexican economies, and it is good for companies that are trying to show that they're de-risking. But it might not actually have any real effect on the levels of interdependence between Westerners and the Chinese market.
No, and I think another way of putting that is that decoupling is harder than it looks. And certainly individual firms, when they start looking at the way in which moving tier one manufacturing into Vietnam will just pull your Chinese second and third tier suppliers into that same supply chain, it's a very knotty problem to solve. I mean, it can still act as a mitigant if what you're worried about, for example, is something like a trade defense duty where you're going to have origin in Vietnam in a way that means that having some Chinese content doesn't matter. But actually, if you look at something, this makes your point, Mark, if you look at something like the data in the US on interdiction of goods at the border under the Uyghur Protection Act, most of them come from Vietnam and Malaysia, but they've got Chinese content in them and they're being intercepted and impounded for that reason. So as you say, it's much more complicated than a superficial suggestion that you can merely pull up production and locate it elsewhere in ASEAN or Vietnam might suggest. And that's, of course, why it's such a challenge for corporate strategy.
So let's talk about China's perspective on all this. I get you wrote an article recently which had the headline, "The West did not invent decoupling, China did." Do you want to explain what you meant by that?
Yes, definitely. And I think it ties very well to the broader conversation. I think that China has been doing de-risking for longer than Western economies. When we take a look at things, you know, it's all about tech, it's all about finance, and it's all about trade. In terms of tech, when we take a look at China's strategy in the field, it's all about tech self-sufficiency because China sees this as an existential imperative. And it started even before Trump became US president. The blueprint strategy was the Made in China 2025 strategy, and China released it in 2015. So before we even started talking about de-risking or decoupling. And I think it's really interesting here to acknowledge the fact that China is a technological leader in many fields. Clean tech, for instance, it's the world leader by all means in terms of clean tech. And I think that China knows that this gives the country leverage also over Western economies. Then I was mentioning finance. You know, when we take a look at things, China has been doing de-risking in finance for a long, long time. There is no foreign involvement in Chinese financial markets, pretty much. Foreigners control only 2% of Chinese bank assets, 4% of Chinese stocks. And I think that this has been really a conscious strategy from the Chinese leadership in that field to insulate themselves from others, from potential adversaries. And also there's all these efforts to, well, insulate China potentially from sanctions, you know, with the development of renminbi payments, with development of alternatives to SWIFT. So the Chinese alternative is called SIBS. I think we had discussed this, Mark, in a previous podcast. So it's all about insulating China, Chinese economy from Western economies. And then finally, trade. You know, we all have these discussions about, okay, is the US importing more or less from China? Actually, it's very interesting because Chinese customs say that China's exports to the US are growing, but US data say they're, well, dropping. So there is something here. And I would say here that the interesting thing is that many American importers have an interest in underestimating their imports from China so that they don't face tariffs. But that's another conversation. In terms of trade, what we're seeing, and we would need to use Chinese statistics here, so of course, usual caveats apply, but what we see is that trade between China and Western economies is gradually dropping, whereas trade with other economies, the emerging economies, is rising. And I think this is a diversification, de-risking strategy from China, actually less reliance on Western economies. So when we take all of this together, for me, it's very clear that China has been doing de-risking and decoupling for a long, long time. The Chinese economists hate the word de-risking, but I think that China actually is probably the world leader in the field. And that's really interesting, as you said, to take a look at things from China, because I don't think we should expect China not to react to Western policies. So that's, yeah, that's in a nutshell.
So, Stephen, if we put all of that together, you worked for a long time on global trade in the European Commission. And when you were there, I think the kind of prevailing orthodoxy in Brussels was very much one to do with seeing a rule-based, open global trading order as the goal, and that meant that the main role for the state in Europe was about protecting consumers and stopping state aids and doing competition policy. We're looking at quite a different world now from the one that the Brussels wanted to live in. How do you see the global economy emerging as a result of the trends that we've been talking about?
Well, I think actually one of the things that helps explain the difference in the response of the US and the EU, say, actually is at its core the EU's residual commitment to a rules-based order. One of the reasons why you have European policymakers, for example, wanting to try and push European norms down into European supply chains with things like due diligence frameworks, or hoping that they're going to be able to rely on tools like the trade defense system, or very carefully boxing their de-risking strategy in around the exceptions in the WTO rulebook around national security, is precisely because they have that residual commitment to a rules-based order, which US policy for the last 10 years has, broadly speaking, jettisoned. Brussels policymakers are nowhere near wanting to go where the US has gone, for example, on things like non-discrimination. So actually, I think Brussels in some ways is still hanging on to the hope that it's going to be able to have a de-risking strategy that is broadly compatible with the rules-based order that it helped to create.
And what do we think is going to happen in the future under different scenarios? Because obviously Donald Trump started to implement a lot of the ideas which have become central now in many parts of the world. You know, he moved on from trade wars and tariffs into all sorts of other areas of de-risking, using export controls and import controls, and looking at technology as a particularly powerful way of trying to contain China.
You know, he might be back in the White House quite soon. But even if he doesn't, a lot of the demons that or the genies that he released from the bottle have carried on living under the Biden administration. I mean, where do we? What? How does this de-risking debate go forward under different scenarios? If Trump reemerges as president, or if the US kind of thinks about the next wave of its activism around de-risking,
I think that what we see in the US is a strong bipartisan consensus on China. So I wouldn't really believe that a Trump scenario would meaningfully change the direction of trouble. I think that it's a very clear direction of trouble. And I think that under Biden, under Trump, we'll see the same thing. You know, we'll see increased interest in export controls and therefore in cutting off China's access to Western technology. We'll also see a lot of interest in industrial policy. The only difference, I would say, between a Trump and a Biden scenario is about working with allies, because, of course, Trump has difficulties working with allies. It's not really his style. Whereas Biden has actually done a great job at working with allies. You know, just the revival of the G7 to me is really striking. A few years ago, the G7 wasn't exactly playing a huge role in these discussions. But today, it's really the forum where there is coordination of like-minded allies on export controls, on sanctions, on all these things related to de-risking and China. So I think that's, to me, the only difference. But in terms of the direction of travel, I don't think that we're looking at any massive difference between a Trump and a Biden scenario.
In terms of what they've signaled, I mean, I think if a Trump administration was to go where it has occasionally signaled on tariffs, then you'd be looking at quite a big additional disruptive impact in terms of U.S. supply chains. I totally agree with Agatha on everything else. I think, in fact, the most interesting thing, and I mean interesting in inverted commas, about the Biden administration has been the continuity. And I think that's partly because the frustration with the multilateral trading system and the way that it provided leverage on China is in fact an Obama phenomenon. And much, of course, of the underpinning of US strategy, which is coming out of the national security community, it is essentially has been accepted on a bipartisan basis. So I wouldn't expect, I mean, I think we could definitely see the rhetoric get tougher. I think we could definitely, we need to watch very carefully what happens on tariffs. I agree that a Trump administration would almost certainly want to make even more acute the sense in Europe that this is a binary choice and you have to come down on one side or the other. But that's, of course, something that the Biden administration, in its more subtle way, has essentially been communicating as well. So it could get a bit worse, but I think we have quite a lot of continuity irrespective of who's in the White House.
And yet, big American companies like Apple, for example, don't seem to be making a binary choice.
No, but that's partly, I think, because the US government at this point on things like access to the IRA hasn't made that demand for a binary choice as acute as it could be. I mean, obviously, the Dutch government, Dutch companies, Japanese companies, they've come under forms of pressure to see the choice between servicing the Chinese and the American markets as a binary choice. But no, we haven't had an American administration yet that's actually been willing to codify that in the most acute diplomatic terms. And maybe that's something we should be looking out for under a Trump administration.
I think that's something here is that the US has been focusing really on the defense question, you know, not fueling the capabilities of the Chinese military. So I think that this is why we see this focus on semiconductors, because all modern defense gear embarks semiconductors, missiles, for instance. But this may be the reason why there is no ask from companies like Apple, which don't really do dual-use goods, to make a binary choice between the US and the Chinese markets. Maybe just a word about the Trump scenario. I think that what we would see in terms of tariffs, you know, Trump has said he would impose a 60% tariffs on all Chinese imports and a 10% tariff on everyone else. So what we would see is also a revival of trade tensions between both sides of the Atlantic. And that could play into China's hand, because China is very keen to see fragmentation between like-minded Western allies. This is much better for Chinese interests, you know, if there is no coordination. So I think that, again, it goes back to this question of working with allies, which to me is really the crucial difference between a Trump and a Biden scenario.
It would deflect imports into the EU market as well, which would be an acute new source of tension, I'm sure.
So we're running out of time now. We obviously have to do some more podcasts on these topics, but there is one thing left to do on this podcast, and that's our bookshelf segment. Agathe, what's on your bookshelf at the moment?
Well, on my bookshelf at the moment, I read Underground Empire from Henry Farrell and Abraham Newman, which is actually all about these questions, also, and all about economic statecraft, all about the weaponization of economic tools from the US. And the book argues there was no big conspiracy from the US to use, for instance, the US dollar to weaponize the US dollar. But it still happened. And the book talks a bit about China, you know, about China doing the same things today than the things that the US did a few decades ago. And I highly recommend the book. It's really a great read.
And what about you, Stephen?
Well, actually, I've just been rereading Dominic Sandbrook's State of Emergency, his history of the years 1972 to 1974 in British politics. And the reason I was rereading that was to see whether it's possible for British politics to be more dysfunctional than they are at the moment. And spoiler alert, they can.
Great. Well, I hope you've been enjoying listening to us over the last few minutes. We'll put links up to all the publications we mentioned on our website, ecfr.eu. If you want to listen to more of our podcast, please head to whatever platform you use to download this episode from and subscribe to future episodes. And while you're there, it would be wonderful if you could give us a positive review and a 5-star rating. But for now, from Agathe, Stephen, and myself, Mark Leonard, it's goodbye. The researcher of this podcast is Anand Sundar, and the editor of this episode is Mireya Farrow-Saratz.